As predictable as a Pirelli Super Soft and as funny as a Tony Fernandez tweet. Yes, the Autosport podcast is back. Your regular host, Henry Hope Frost, is off celebrating his anniversary. We think it's the Fever Carbon Fibre one. So it's been left to me, Alan Hyde, to fill the void. And joining me in today's podcast are Autosport's editor-in-chief, Andrew Vanderbert.
Hello.
F1 editor, Ed Straw.
Hello.
Podcast favourite Sky F1 pundit and GT racer, Karen Chanduk.
Hello, Alan.
And making his pod debut, a very warm welcome to F1 racing editor Anthony Rowlandson.
Hello.
With four races down in the F1 season, and on the face of it, we have four very exciting events, but there is increasing disquiet about the realness of the racing that we're seeing. On the cover of the new Autosport, the question is posed as to whether the fragile tyres and DRS are ruining F1. So the question, gentlemen, is, are they? I've answered already. I've put down yes. Andy?
I think it's a complicated question, and I'm in the sort of agnostic camp, but erring on the side of no. I think you only have to have a relatively short memory to go back to 2010 and just how terrible things were. And I think I'd take what we're seeing over that any time. Also, what I keep coming back to is the cars and the drivers that are winning races. And the races are being won by the best drivers in the best cars. If we were seeing Force Indias or Saubers or whatever winning races while Ferraris and Red Bulls were going backwards, I think we were having a problem. But we're seeing the best drivers in the best cars winning races. And the opening few laps in Bahrain, you know, the moves that Vettel pulled on Alonso, that's some of the best F1 racing I've ever seen. So I'd take that over what happened in 2010, as Ed writes in the mag this week, at Bahrain especially, any day of the week.
Karen?
I actually tend to agree with VDB. I think it was interesting listening to Lewis Hamilton on a chat show earlier last week, saying he thought the ratio of car and driver is now 70 car, 30% driver in terms of the end result. And I think VDB is exactly right. If you go back to the Bridgestone era, it was probably, I don't know, 85-15. And I think now you're seeing drivers having to use the tyres in the best way. The guys who are able to really maximise the grip over one lap. I mean, Rosberg's quali lap, I thought, in Bahrain was exceptional. But, you know, in the race, for whatever reason, it didn't happen for him. And you got people like Lewis who started further back and, you know, just patiently waited and waited and managed the tyres in the first half, fairly anonymous, and then did a great job towards the end. So I think, you know, the drivers are coming into play a lot more. I think it's frustrating for the guys in the cockpit, though. I can understand it from their point of view, having been in situations where you just have to manage tyres that are falling, you know, falling apart. It is frustrating from them, but from the outside, it's fantastic for the show.
I think the important thing to remember, though, is that F1, to an extent, has to be artificial, insofar as, for a long time in Grand Prix racing history, it was technology that was the limitation. Technology combined with what money you could throw at it. And over time, gradually, you went from having a minimum or maximum weight and maybe an engine capacity to more and more rules coming in. But it's come to the point where F1 has to decide what it wants to be and set the parameters accordingly. You know, we've got Pirelli control tyres. These are bespoke ground-up control tyres, which is actually the first time there's been a situation where you've had a tyre supplier who's providing that sort of rubber on that basis, rather than just tyre war era tyres that just happen to be available to everyone. Andrew pointed out, the best drivers and teams are generally winning, which is the important thing. And also, if you look at those who are complaining the most, they're the ones who stand to gain the most. The ones who are complaining the least are the ones who are maybe gaining a little bit of an advantage from it. So I think you've got to be really, really careful about listening to certain drivers on their with their arguments about whether F1 should or should not be this. And also, I take a certain degree of issue with the idea that drivers in the past were driving at 100%. Sky Sports have been showing recently some full-length classic races. I had Bahrain 2007 on the other day. And ultimately, because you couldn't overtake, there were times where you would sit behind another car, drive around for your stint, then you'd gun it on your in and your out lap. Have I passed him? No. Okay, I'll sit behind him for another stint and try again. It's not quite driving at 100%. It's a great myth. And if you go back further into the past, there were times where drivers had to manage engines, tyres, brakes. It was a minor miracle getting certain cars to the finish of a Grand Prix half the time. And while that was limited by the technology as opposed to by the rules this time, it doesn't mean that the whole ethos of Formula One has changed dramatically.
Okay, Anthony, welcome first of all.
Hello.
Very good.
Well, there's a lot of very valid points made there, but I think my reservation with what's going on at the moment is that it all feels a little bit artificial and a bit comedy and a bit sort of cartoonish, and I think there's actually too many passing moves going on, and that may be heresy to say it, given the way we saw F1, say, in the Michael Schumacher era, dominated with bespoke Bridgestones and that kind of stuff. But I think it's gone a little bit too far at the moment, and I think it's a shame we've lost the art of defence in Formula One. You know, you can't defend against the driver with DRS behind you. And that, you know, in the past, we've had some great races, Haramo 81 with Villeneuve, just to take one example off the top of my head. We won't see that in the current era of Formula One. And OK, we are seeing something else, which is very entertaining, and it's not all bad. But I think the balance needs to be redressed somewhat.
OK, well, I'm going to sit on Anthony's side here, because I would completely agree with that, Karun.
Well, I think, actually, Anthony's brought a valid point, because when we were talking about it, it was more from the tyre point of view. But I think I tend to agree. I think the DRS was brought in primarily because overtaking was so difficult pre-2010. And I think it sort of coincided with the Pirelli era. And I think having now watched the first four races, I would say we could do without DRS, because I think we'll see plenty of overtaking, but without the comedy sort of, you know, false angle that Anthony's talking about. I think you'll see genuine last-minute dives without DRS today.
Andy?
I think DRS is a symptom of a different malaise that Formula One's got itself in, and that's that for decades teams have built up themselves around aerodynamic efficiency. They have enormous design offices, incredible CFD facilities, wind tunnels that run around the clock, and these have created cars that are so super critical, and they don't really create a toe in the way that old cars do. They can't really race closely together. But because of that, like turkeys don't vote for Christmas, the teams are unwilling to change the regulations that mean that those sort of powerhouse of aero ability they've built up will be negated. Because what you'd really want are cars that have ground effect and are less dependent on their surface aero, so they can run closely together. You don't need DRS then. But because they refuse to, or are unable to come to an agreement on that, you have this halfway house. And I mean, there is no denying it's completely artificial, but how artificial were those Monza slipstreamers in the 70s? Because effectively, the way that toes have been reduced by the aero that comes off the car now, all that is a replication of the old toe that cars used to have in the days when they were just to create a hole of air for the cars to go into.
Yeah, I think you have to be a little bit careful about that. I don't remember Dennis Jenkinson complaining at length about Hawthorne and Fangio swapping positions too much in the French Grand Prix, or this terrible artificial overtaking when Jackie Stewart and Jochen Rindt could slipstream past each other at Silverstone. But the point about the DRS is very valid, but there's a difference between there being something there in the DRS that can be used and maybe could be used in a better way, arguably, and the fact that the whole ethos of Formula One is ruined. Personally, actually, I think there's an argument, if you want to continue with the DRS, to limit it to a certain number of uses, etc., change the way it's applied, and also spend a little bit more time researching the length of the DRS zones, because that's hugely, hugely significant. Because the aim was to create contested braking zones, which it has in some places, but it is difficult because, you know, 10, 20 metres can make the difference between a pretty easy overtake and a contested braking zone.
I think there's an interesting point that Andy made, though, that DRS is in effect a band-aid, isn't it, to a problem. And you're trying to cover up the fact that cars with such sophisticated aerodynamics can't pass each other, and this is something that Karun obviously would have first-hand experience of. Really, I think what you want to do is address the fundamentals, not try and stick something on that makes it artificially entertaining. And I was chatting with someone joking the other week, saying, why don't we ban wind tunnels? And okay, fine, it would be a radical move, save a lot of money, and suddenly the teams have an emphasis on track testing and engine development, for example. And the whole basis of Formula One would change, not necessarily for the worse. Why not do it?
It was really interesting chatting with Damon Hill in China about exactly this thing, you know, what do we think can be done to make overtaking better without DRS and less faults. And, you know, we both kind of concluded at the end of it, if you just look at GP2, I mean, I raced GP2 for 3 years and there's loads of overtaking. And it was exactly, as Andy said before, the downforces created from the floor. The engines had loads of torque, so you would destroy the rear tyres quite quickly. So the drivers who managed the tyres would have grip at the end. And you could follow cars. Not as easily as, you know, you'd like, but you could still follow cars closer than you could in Formula One because the downforce was created from the floor. So I'm sure that there can be a rule created by designers far cleverer than the four of us sat, you know, in a design office somewhere. I don't know, is there an overtaking working group? Does it still exist? But I'm sure they could come up with a plan of how big a step you need in the floor to create underflow downforce.
Okay, Anthony, would you be happy if we asked the question, no DRS, but the tyres as they are now?
It would be an interesting thing to try, wouldn't it? It's quite difficult to answer off the top of my head. I think there would certainly be enough variation in performance between the teams. We'd certainly see a lot of changes. We'd still see things probably like Nico Rosberg qualifying on pole and slipping to ninth because Mercedes can't sort their rear tyre wear out. So there'd still be a lot of variation in the pack.
Just coming back to this point about changing the aerodynamic rules dramatically, which is definitely something well worth looking at, but equally at the same time you could say that's an artificial measure, which feeds back into this thing I was saying about people who bandy around ideas of what's artificial, what isn't, what's the purist approach, I think are slightly missing the point. You have to create the rule set that you want. And I think it's a little bit unhelpful in a debate to throw around things like artificial, etc. You need to sit down, look at what you want to do, what you want to achieve. And that may be getting rid of DRS, changing the aerodynamic rules. There's a very, very good argument and debate to be had there. But until the debate's had on these sensible terms that actually almost remove the emotion from it, we're going to keep going around in circles.
I guess ultimately the success or failure of this is determined by the viewing figures. And from my understanding is they're broadly up. So while it might be disappointing or offending some of the purists as a worldwide spectacle, which is for better or worse what the sport is now, you have to say it's working.
I think from a spectator point of view, I find it a bit stressful. There's a lot to, you know, I have a lot to take in, and I actually quite used to enjoy sitting down on a Sunday afternoon and watching a race and that being all I had to worry about.
You can't go for a cup of tea anymore, can you?
No, not really. No, you can't. I feel terribly sorry for the commentators. They're doing an excellent job. We need to move on. A quick glance at the points table shows that Sebastian Vettel, of course, is on top. But following his win in Malaysia and now the infamous multi-21 team order that he ignored, do you think people's attitudes have changed towards the triple world champion as a driver, Karen, first of all?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, it is really interesting seeing the turnaround in him, in his body language in China. I mean, I don't know, Ed, you were at the press conference as well. And you could just, you know, from Malaysia on the podium, sort of pretending at least at the time to be apologetic and all of that, till you get to Shanghai, it was a totally different bloke. You know, absolutely 180-degree turnaround. Couldn't really be bothered about anyone else but himself. And, you know, it was really interesting, once again, just chatting with people who raced in the Michael Schumacher era. I mean, obviously, I was working with Sky at the weekend. We had Johnny Herbert, who was Michael's teammate, and Damon, who obviously has the long history. And they both, we were all at the press conference together, and they just looked at each other and said, it's like watching watching Michael in many ways, you know, his complete conviction in what they've done and whether other people agree or not.
Anthony?
Well, I'd have to say, I think we have seen a different Vettel. In our magazine this month, we've actually put half his face covered by a Darth Vader helmet, which has gone down very well in some quarters with our readers, but less well in others, as you might imagine. I won't elaborate, but you can imagine where that hasn't met with approval. But I think really what we saw is the real Seb. And the thing that, in a way, frustrates and disappoints me is that there's efforts are being made to try and make Vettel now something that he never was. Why should we disrespect him for being a ruthless racing driver? Okay, maybe he shouldn't have passed Mark the way he did, straightforwardly disobeying team orders and taking advantage of a teammate who felt he was racing to control parameters when Vettel clearly didn't think he was. That's a slightly different argument. But just to say that now we think less of Vettel because we've seen his ruthlessness, I think is wrong. I mean, let's respect him for being ruthless. He's doing the thing he should. Whether he did the right thing at Malaysia is a slightly different question. I think he probably did a very bad thing that day, but I don't think he regrets it for 1 minute.
Made for great telly.
Absolutely, and my respect and admiration for him hasn't changed one iota, really. I think if he'd have just sat behind there in the way that Rosberg did to Hamilton, I think my respect would have diluted slightly. If he had lost, or if he ends up losing this world championship or winning it by a margin of less than 7 points, his actions will have been proved absolutely correct. And you want guys out there that are there to win. That's what I want to watch. I want to watch guys that are out there to win.
I think a part of this supposed change in attitude comes from people having a slightly strange outlook on things. I guess it's natural in sport. People look to have heroes and villains. There's a piece I wrote on autosport.com up at the moment talking about this. But, you know, the best drivers have to be ruthless. You have to be ruthless and single-minded. Seb was wrong to ignore a team order because it's not just about him and his teammate. and the World Championship. It's about a whole team of hundreds of people, and that was a big mistake on his part, and he probably realises partly that was an error, even though his stance in China, I think, showed that he knew he had to run with it and actually ran with it pretty well. But the fact is, all of these guys are like that. Alonso do the same. Well, not necessarily do the same, but Alonso makes sure he's the driver who's backed all the time. Senna did certain things, vetoing certain teammates. And you can pick any driver. Fangio changing teams all the time because he wanted to be in the best machinery. Well, why not? And I think this is the thing that people have to remember when they're looking at these people. They are humans. They're not the good guy and the bad guy. Mark's disregarded team orders in the past. He's had reasons for that. That's fine. They've both done it. Every driver's had moments like that.
I'm really enjoying this podcast because everybody wants to get involved in the things we're talking about, Karun.
I don't disagree with the fact that the great world champions were all ruthless, and you know they had a certain amount of drive and etc. that everyone else has said. What I do disagree with is him blatantly coming out and trying to cover it up and lie about it. You know, in that press conference, he sat there and told the world's press and all the TV channels, I didn't understand Multi-21. I was looking on the steering wheel for a switch. Now, come on. Especially when, you know, at Spa last year, he was the one on the radio going Multi-1-2, Multi-1-2. So that's a bit I don't like, is when people, you know, if you're going to do it, but don't come out and lie about it.
Is that just an age thing? I mean, he's still a really young guy, isn't he? Isn't that what you do when you're
young? I think we've seen Vettel grow up. I think he's learned a life lesson. I know that sounds a bit sort of profound, but I think he has, because they're growing up in public. They're still such young guys. I mean, what was he, 20 when he came to F1? And I think you've seen that. You see this very rapid development of them as humans and as drivers. And, you know, Vettel's in so much in the public eye. And then, wow, he's done something really nasty. but he didn't. I don't think he realised the reaction he'd get. You could see it on his face when he got out of the car in Malaysia. It was like, all smiley Seb, and then suddenly, that might not have been such a good idea. And that was a real moment for him.
Andy?
I just think there's a delicious irony that he's often criticised for not being able to overtake, and he passes his teammate and gets more criticism.
Ed. I think if we see, again, in future, Seb doing anything that he has to explain like this, I think he has learned that you can't kind of try and fudge your way through it. He did look a bit stupid in that press conference because he was apologising, then saying, I'm not apologising for certain things, and it didn't make a great deal of sense. And I think he did go then on to China and to a degree make a little bit more sense, although again there were a few inconsistencies there, but I think that's part of the learning process, isn't it? But also I think the thing that Seb has also learned is that Mark Webber in the past has been very good at making his point in press conferences, actually often by not saying too much but saying enough. And I guess Seb perhaps next time will try and make his point a little bit more clearly and concisely, and ensure that he doesn't tie himself in these knots again.
With the personality that Vettel has got and his humour, he could have made that press conference work in his favour, couldn't he? He could have actually turned it around and hands up, you know, full confession, really.
He certainly could have done. He could have. I mean, he got halfway towards it in China, where he just came up with this stuff about Mark not deserving to win, etc. But we also have to put this into context. He's not parked at Raskas to ruin someone else's qualifying lap. He's not driven his title rival off the road. You know, that's a whole different level. You know, he's not Lance Armstrong, is he?
He treated us to a really exciting bit of TV, so I quite enjoyed that. Anthony?
There's just one thing I wanted to mention in this, which is obviously Webber's sort of portrayed as the underdog here, but I think what's fascinating about that dynamic and their relationship is that you've got a so-called number two driver who is actually capable of beating a guy who's a treble world champion and a very good one. And were that team to be Mark Webber's and he had a subservient number two, Webber's definitely talented enough to be a world champion. He may not be Vettel, but he's racing in an era of extreme competitiveness at the top level. He's just not quite as good as Seb, but he can beat him. And it's going to keep throwing up these fascinating little scenarios like this. And to their credit, you have to say, well done Red Bull for hanging onto that driver pairing, because if they plugged in, I don't know, Sebastian Buemi, no disrespect to him, but he wouldn't be able to hold a candle to Vettel, but you know, Webber obviously can and will continue to do so.
And knows how to deal with the psychological warfare within the team as well, which is a huge part of it, isn't it?
Well, you might argue that he brings it upon himself, but there's a whole different world of stuff you could get into with that, but it's fascinating.
Karun.
I just can't wait for Interlagos if by chance Mark ends up ahead of Sebastian as he did last year. And Sebastian has to pass him for the world championship. I tell you what, all Christian's foot will be twitching there.
I think you're right. Well, let's talk about Mark Webber, because the rumours about him leaving Formula One to join Porsche at Le Mans refuse to go away. They seem to be ever present nowadays. Are Mark's days in Formula One numbered, Anthony, first of all?
I don't know. I think it depends where his head ends up. I'd say from the look of him and his competitiveness this year, he's driven well in the start of the season, pretty well. I don't think he needs to retire. I don't think there's a performance issue that would see him quit that you might have argued Michael Schumacher had last year. Whether he wants to stay is a different question, and obviously we all hear different things about that. I don't think he'll stay at Red Bull for another season. I think, sadly, Weber-Vettel is over at the end of this year.
Ed?
I suspect it's almost out of Mark's hands. If he has the chance to stay in Formula 1 with a good team, and I wouldn't 100% rule out Red Bull, although I suspect him staying there is untenable. You know, this guy, he's determined. He, by rights, he should never really have made it to F1 with the amount of backing he had. And when he did get in, it was on a 3-4 race deal with Minardi, and he probably thought, well, I'll get there, I'll start a few races at the back. That's a hell of an achievement from where I'm coming from. And then we look 10, 11 years on, and here he is. From Red Bull's point of view, they have to be very careful about choosing a replacement, because if you look at Mark's record over the last few years, he guarantees you a few wins, a hatful of points, and he has played an important role in them winning the Constructors' Championship. So they'll give a decent amount of thought before giving them the axe. But I suspect Mark, if he can stay in a good car, will stay on. I'm not convinced he'd be that interested in driving around in the midfield just for the sake of it. And in that situation, maybe he will do what various F1 drivers will do when they're all washed up and go and race in sports cars.
Yeah, Karun, thoughts on Mark?
I think Ed's right. I mean, I don't see Mark being a Rubens. I don't see Mark, driving around in midfield teams or a Trulli or a, Fisichella for that. I think he's in it to win. I know he's got a great relationship with Porsche, which he's had a personal relationship with for a long time. It makes sense. I think the WEC and Le Mans is something he would look forward to doing again. I agree with Ed. I think if he can't stay at Red Bull, I don't see him staying in F1.
Andy?
I think the only option is possibly a swap between him and Kimi. Kimi come into Red Bull and maybe Mark go into Lotus. We've seen that they're capable of producing race-winning cars, and maybe being a de facto team leader might interest him. But I don't know how likely that is. It may be that Red Bull want to promote one of their junior drivers. It's been quite a while since they did that. Ricardo's doing quite a good job, so maybe they might feel a bit of loyalty to putting him in the seat. So who knows? But I think if he did go off to Porsche and WEC, it'd be a good chance for him to really show how talented a driver he is. And what driver wouldn't want a Le Mans win on their CV? So I think it's a good career move.
From my point of view, looking in as an outsider, I see Mark Webber as an unchanged guy, an unchanged character over the years of F1. F1 can change people dramatically, can't it? But there he was on Sunday afternoon, turned up at Silverstone, presented prizes to young drivers on the podium for BRDC Formula 4, and seemed completely at ease and happy to be doing that, Anthony.
I think one of Mark's most endearing qualities is that while he's massively committed to motor racing and Formula 1, it's not his whole life. And you know that when he stops, he'll be able to go away, walk his dogs, maybe retire to Australia, whatever it is he'll do, and he'll be satisfied. He'll find satisfaction in what he does in a way that perhaps someone like Michael Schumacher probably couldn't do that. But I think Mark will be fine in his head when he quits, as long as it's on his own terms. I think if, just say, Red Bull decided they couldn't have him this season, I think that would really rankle, and that would be a bad thing for Mark. But if, as long as he can quit on his own terms when he chooses to, he'll be fine.
So much to talk about. Kimi Raikkonen and Fernando Alonso are the other drivers to win a race this season. And we are still at a very early stage in the Formula One season. Are they Vettel's strongest rivals this year, Karun?
Yes, I think it's quite simple, really. I mean, it's quite clear that all of the top teams have got a number one, a number two driver going for the championship, seemingly. I think Lewis has established himself, although Nico did a great job in qualifying. When it came to the points, it was still Lewis who bagged the points. Kimi has strongly outperformed Roman. Alonso, we all know, is clearly number one. And I think, Vettel is again edging away from Mark if you look at Bahrain and Shanghai. So I think, out of those, I don't think Mercedes are yet really championship contenders. So you'd have to say Kimi and Alonso. And the Ferrari is strong and competitive. I mean, Alonso, even those two laps when the DRS was wide open, he was still hanging on, wasn't he? He was ahead of Durista, and actually, he dropped 7-8 tenths or a second or so to Vettel, which wasn't bad, considering the loss of downforce.
Andy,
I completely agree. I don't see McLaren turning it around quick enough. I don't think that Mercedes are going to be consistently quick enough to allow Hamilton to mount a charge. But I think, like Karun says, the Ferrari's good enough. And I think the Lotus is too, but certainly the way it manages its tyres for Kimi to get consistently strong results. And we saw last year, he can just relentlessly bring the car home, and that's going to help this year. You know, a retirement or a poor finish could really derail the championship.
Ed?
I think Alonso and Ferrari might have reason to rue a couple of decisions made in the first four races. The front wing thing at Malaysia was surprising. I think they were looking a little bit too closely at the pace he was able to do and the downforce that the wing was producing, and not actually looking on the screen and saying, hang on, that's a wing that's properly deranged. I think they slightly overcomplicated it there. I think they could have got themselves a decent bag of points there. And allowing him to redeploy the DRS after you come in to fix it seemed odd. I mean, I asked Stefano Domenicali after the race about this, and they said, well, in the pit stop, you don't have time to do it all properly to make sure it all works, but he'd been better off just saying don't use it again, because it wouldn't have taken many seconds for him to be fifth odd in that race. Probably could have been ahead of Lewis, which would have made a big difference to the championship position. He's over a race win behind now, which is difficult to come back from. It's really early days, but you just can't afford to let these points leak away. That's what's so strong about last year. For the most part, the only race where Alonso and Ferrari didn't get somewhere near what they should have done in terms of maximum points was Suzuka, where Fernando made a bit of a misjudgment off the start.
Anthony?
Yeah, it's definitely Kimi and Alonso. Yeah. I think the fascinating thing will be to see whether Kimi and Renault can maintain that sort of form that they've got, because that's a quick car, and Kimi's really got his mojo back now. So if they can sustain a season-long championship challenge, that'll be fun.
Who would have predicted that 2 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. And our next week's magazine is going to be looking at whether that Lotus team sort of pound for pound the best team in F1, because they don't have resources like McLaren, Ferrari and Red Bull do yet on track. They're every bit the competition for
really
them.
Impressive. Yeah, Karen.
I completely agree. I think they're one of the most efficient teams, and they have been traditionally, even if, you know, 05, 06, even with all that Mile 7 sponsorship and Renault backing, they still had a lot less to spend than McLaren and Ferrari. From what we understand. And I think Kimi's consistency, I mean, the guy, I can't remember the last time he made a mistake, and, you know, a big one that cost a whole heap of points. He's been superb since he came back.
Interlagos was funny last year, wasn't it? Driving up and
But you'd have to say that Kimi's great strength, he's extremely good at executing a full race performance, if you see what I mean. I mean, the Bahrain drive is very good. Qualifying was a little bit disappointing. If he'd replicated his Q2 time or put his sectors together, he'd have been in a much stronger position. But race-wise, like Alonso, really, he's able to be relentlessly quick and able to, you know, make a few passing moves where a stick when he needs to. And he does seem to have got somewhere close to his best.
Well, this whole chat about, you know, how his work ethic and how committed he is, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, on one hand, yeah, it's a point to talk about. But, you know, I saw him on Saturday morning in Shanghai stroll into the paddock at 10:35. So that's 25 minutes before the session. So there's no chance of, like, the pre-session meeting an hour before, none of the big, you know, briefings, none of that. Rocked up, put his helmet on, and he was straight on it. And even on the Friday, you know, he was nowhere in FP1 and kind of clumsy little spin and all that. But as soon as the option tires came on and came time for quali runs, bang, he was there, P2. And, you know, I think that's the mark of him, is that he knows when it's important. He knows when he has to dig out that extra 2-3 tenths in quali and bring that consistency in the race. He knows what to do.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
So imagine what he would have been like if he would have been there at 8 o'clock in the morning. I mean, would that maybe?
I don't think so. I think that's what I mean. I think this is his personality,
and
I think it works for him at the moment, because the team let him do what he wants, and therefore he's delivering the way he can.
Anthony,
just to go back to your original question about challenging Red Bull and beating them. Obviously, that means Ferrari and Lotus have to beat Red Bull, right? And that's an obvious thing to say. But I thought, perhaps in Malaysia and China, you saw the beginning of a Red Bull implosion. And I thought, oh, they really are going to start losing it here and things are going to start unfolding. But to their immense credit, you know, completely dominant performance in Bahrain. And I think bouncing back like that does show the strength of the team. And that's what Ferrari and Lotus and Kimi and Alonso have actually got to do better than over a season. And that's not an easy thing.
Ed. I think that's a valid point. I have a suspicion that McLaren's misstep with the car going aggressive in the last year of a rules package was caused by the fact that they've not quite been able to get Red Bull, and they felt they had to pull something out of the bag. I think Ferrari's gambles with Alonso in these two races have been motivated by exactly the same thing, the feeling that you've got to just reach for every single point in order to beat them, and almost they're undoing themselves through that overreaching, because Red Bull has gone from being, you know, a team with a quick car that made errors, and then gradually we saw them tightening up through 2009, 2010 to just being a very, very effective unit. And I think that's actually testament to the way the team's operated.
Now, we've touched on Mercedes. Before the season started, an awful lot of people were questioning the wisdom, I think, of Lewis Hamilton's switch to Mercedes from McLaren. He's been pretty fully vindicated in the races so far this year, hasn't he?
Well, I think there's two elements to that question. Insofar as personally, he clearly had to leave McLaren, and so going to Mercedes was a good decision. In terms of purely looking at the performance of the team and the car, I think it's really too early. Realistically, anything he gets this year is a bonus, I think. 2014 is the key. Can they produce a car that will be competitive there? And also, as far as being vindicated already, they've had a quick car in the first four weekends. Great, but they had that last year. They won the Chinese Grand Prix. They were qualifying well. Come Brazil, they were, you know, behind midfield teams, and getting into Q3 was about the limit of their ambitions. I think we have to take quite a long view of the Hamilton to Mercedes move in terms of the pure performance, but there's no doubt whatsoever that he did need to leave McLaren, and all Mercedes needed to do was show that it was a viable alternative. So really, either way you look at it, it's a decent move.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Ed said. Basically, his decision will be genuinely validated next year, and when you see what their 2014 cars are like.
Karen?
Well, looking at Mercedes on its own, I think it was really interesting to see them have pole at the last two races at circuits which are completely different. You know, Shanghai is very much long corners to tighten up and really front limited, whereas Bahrain is all about traction, stop and go, and they were at pole for both of them, which wasn't the case last year. You know, I think Shanghai was a bit of a one-off for them last year. Well, it was. And they were competitive at Monaco, but not quite there. They need to get on top of this tyre wear issue, clearly, because Rosberg shouldn't have gone back so quickly. You know, but on the flip side, Lewis came through the front. So there's the elements are there. And as Ed says, you know, I think if they can string it together and win a couple more races, you know, and win towards the end of the season, win a couple races, rather, towards the end of the season, that builds well for 2014.
Anthony?
I think I agree with what everybody said, actually, that Lewis had to leave, and it's been very good for his personal development, because you can see he's a happier chap these days, even if the car isn't as good as the car he enjoyed last year. It's obviously better than this year's McLaren. I think what's interesting with Mercedes will be when Paddy Lowe goes there, assuming he does, let's say he will, because Mercedes seem to have had this consistent problem ever since they've been back in F1 of rear tyre wear and the car not being a good car to balance, very critical on performance. Clearly the fact that Paddy Lowe is going there, if he goes there, will be manifestation, if you like, of a new technical philosophy, because they clearly feel the need to address something pretty fundamental, which is the car underperforms in the same way. And despite the amazing roster of talent they've got technically, they can't nail it. So they need someone to sort that out.
Let's pick up on McLaren. They seem to have got it so wrong so far. Can they turn it around, Andy?
You would genuinely say yes, just because of the sheer amount of technical resource at their disposal. But because the next year's car being so different, I do wonder whether they may come a point in the season where they just abandon it. And
what
really
would that
think,
point be?
I would say probably the end of the European season. Mm. If it's not, I mean, I think they're convinced that somewhere latently in this car that there is some performance. But I think if they can't untap it within the European season, they may decide that actually working really head down on 2014 is the way to go, rather than doing the typical McLaren thing. Oh, we must win a race this season, because I think that could actually end up putting them in more serious problems further down the line.
Karun.
I think Andy's hit the nail on the head. The question is, you know, I think we'll get an idea earlier than the end of the European season about whether they're really going to fight for the championship or not. Early indications are they're not. So then it becomes a question of how important is it really for McLaren to win a race? I think it's, you know, it's different to Lotus' situation last year, for example, where it was really important for them to get a win, you know, in the bag in this whole new era. In McLaren's situation, yeah, a win's always important, but you know they've won enough over the last few years, and another one isn't really going to matter if it means compromising 2014. So I think that those are the questions that must be addressed at the higher level at Woking.
I think what is absolutely critical for McLaren is they address the causes of these problems. It's fairly clear they've come out with a peaky car. They've got great facilities there, but if you're looking at your peak ideal car state downforce figures to say, right, the car's got that amount of downforce, if you can only produce that downforce for a certain percentage of states and ride heights, you're not going to go anywhere. And it's very, very tempting to look at the number and say, well, we've got 100 points of downforce from that. But if you can only produce 100 points of downforce 25% of the time, you're better off producing 80 points 100% of the time. So the thing our technical editor Gary Anderson's always talking about, that you know, the need to be consistent and to make things actually work reliably, which is why as the aerodynamics have got more complicated, you're getting more slot gaps and things. It's all about making sure the airflow stays attached and just being consistent all the way. In fact, Gary always said that when he was with Jordan and used to present to the board what they had, he'd always give them the lowest downforce figure across all states, and he did that from year to year. So even though he was giving figures that were much lower than some of his rival technical directors, actually in terms of usability and comparison to the previous year, that they worked well. And I think provided McLaren can avoid falling into that trap and chasing, you know, this ideal world aerodynamic platform, they should be all right.
Anthony?
It's like 15 ways to leave your lover, isn't it, with McLaren? 15 ways to lose a championship. They're going to blow another one. There's no possible way they can win this championship. Either championship is, then they've done it again. They've blown another one. I can't believe it. You know, the team that should be winning championships, seamless success, they just can't do it. And there's something really deep rooted there, which is the subject of an analysis that either any of the magazines around this table should be getting into, because there's something at the heart of McLaren that's wrong.
Well, that's just about it for part one, everybody. Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen. We'll be back with part two, where we ask what part of Caterham has been successful and look at the motorsport world away from Formula One. Well, it's been the usual suspects in the midfield, but Force India seem to have got it right, whereas Sauber and Williams in particular seem to have got it very wrong. What's happened there? A year ago, Williams won the Spanish Grand Prix. Now they can't get both cars out of Q1. Oh dear, Karen wants to talk about this.
Well, I mean, I saw loads of bits arriving at the back of the Williams garage in Shanghai, and I think again in Bahrain, you know, they're just chucking loads of bits at it. But from what I understand, and I think it kind of rings true if you look back, is they haven't been able to get the Coanda effect to work properly. They couldn't do it last year. They put it on the car, took it back off. Fortunately for them, the way the exhaust, the blown diffuser worked last year, worked well, and the car was competitive. And for whatever reason, they're not able to replicate what they're seeing in the wind tunnel or back at base on track. You know, I think they've gone off, I believe, to do some aero testing. So the Barcelona update is hugely, hugely important to see if Williams are able to dig themselves out of this.
Ed?
My understanding is that the ability to simulate the exhaust gases in the wind tunnel is a relatively new addition for Williams. Other teams have had it going back further, and everybody struggled with it. It is a difficult thing to simulate, so it could just be an arms race that they started later than everyone else, and they're just a long way behind.
Coincidence that Caterham also used their wind tunnels?
Probably not. Caterham have had exactly the same thing. Last year they had the year before as well, wasn't it? They had much vaunted updates that straight line tested them, didn't work quite as hoped. They were getting a fraction of the expected benefit. So you've got to ask whether there's a certain degree of commonality there. But it's clearly a problem for them, and I'm not sure there's a real shortcut. You can't go from not having the tools to make something work to suddenly making it work without relying on luck, really.
You think back to 2007, I think, wasn't it, where Renault struggled with the wind tunnel problem, and it took them a good 18 months or so to get their cars back on track. You know, when they started to lose their way, they reckon middle of 2006, and Alonso was kind of lucky to hang on to that championship in the end. And you know, exactly as Ed says, there's no shortcut. Maybe the solution is, as Anthony said, to get rid of wind tunnels altogether.
Yeah, you do just wonder, as we were talking about with McLaren, with a team like Williams that have significantly fewer resources at their disposal than the really top teams, can they afford to be so directed on just sorting this problem when there's even bigger problems around the corner with, you know, next year's car?
Well, realistically, sorry, there's little for them to gain this year now. They're so far behind, it's a long way to catch up. Okay, you might be able to catch up, make your car, pick up a few points here and there, but what's the point, really? 14 is going to there's going to come a point where they're going to have to say, well, we're going to have to go even harder on 2014 than than we thought we were going to, and that might come when they bolt the package on the car in Spain and it doesn't solve the problems.
Anthony?
Well, it's sad for Williams, isn't it? Because last year we all thought, finally, this great team had turned the corner. And they haven't. And they appear to be probably slightly worse off than they were in 08 and 09 when they were sort of semi-competitive. This year, it looks pretty dire. And I think back at the team, behind the scenes, there's still quite a lot of restructuring going on there. You hear about technical people having left. Mark Gillen left, obviously, but people junior to that. Claire is now deputy team principal. Toto Wolff has left. Adam Parr left last year. You know, it's still unstable. You look at the really successful teams in F1, like, dare I say it, Red Bull. Rock solid stability. No changes anywhere. Everybody wants to work there. Everybody knows what they're doing. And the end result is this fairly seamless winning machine. And Williams, sadly, aren't that.
And they're such a popular team. People sitting in front of their television sets around the world are just willing them to do well. 12 months is a long time in Formula One, isn't it?
It was the feel-good result of last season, without a shadow of a doubt. And you know, we started this podcast by talking about their not being random results. And on the face of it, that result sort of stands out as being random. But let's not forget, Maldonado started on pole position for that race. They were genuinely competitive, you know, and he drove brilliantly to retake the lead from Alonso and that. But you would say he'll be doing well to get into Q2 this next 2 weekends time when the race is there, which is just a phenomenal turnaround.
Well, I think it's not just Barcelona. You look even towards the end of the season, Maldonado qualified third, I think, in Abu Dhabi. So the car was competitive all the way through. But, I mean, steering towards Force India, you look at them this year, and I think visually you look at the car, it's quite similar to the car they had last year, but there's obviously a lot of detail that's gone into it, and they've understood a lot, I think, about the tyres. I think they're another team like Lotus who can afford to perhaps do one pit stop less. We saw Paul do it in Bahrain, and that on the weekends where you're marginal between a two and a three stop can deliver them points. I mean, the car is quick. It is definitely a Q3 car, but also they're now standing an outside chance of a podium or a top five by running the alternate strategy.
There's no surprise who's making up the tail end either, but Jules Bianchi seems to be making a bit of a name for himself. Who wants to pick this one up, Ed?
Yeah, he's made a good impression so far. It's not a massive surprise because he's been very quick in everything he's done. I think with Jules, the question is whether he can sustain it under pressure, whether he can deliver consistently. That's what he needs to show. In that respect, I think being at Marussia is a good place for him to be. There's not much expectation there, although now, ironically, after the start of the season, there is suddenly a bit of expectation and people are looking at him, and Stefano Domenicali was making positive noises about him. So suddenly it does put him under some pressure. There'll be sterner tests for him ahead. He's going to have to sustain this for the whole season. He might be able to get his way into a team higher up the grid, although Domenicali has said that next year is going to be too early for him to seriously be considered as a driver for them. But he's shown that you can, at a team lower down the grid, make a decent impression.
The challenge for him is that in F1, you tend only to be as good as your last race. At the beginning of the season, Marussia taken a step ahead of Caterham, and so he was able to look like he was doing some quite flattering performances. The last update that Caterham bought found them half a second, which is a sizeable chunk, and all of a sudden he's behind Shell Peak. If that is sustained for the rest of the year, I think the luster may start to peel off a little bit. So while it won't be because of his driving, it'll just be because he's not making the headlines in the same way.
Well, he's doing that thing, isn't he, that you have to do as a new driver if you're going to have a long-term future, which is get yourself noticed for the right reasons, not for, you know, driving world champions off the track. He's doing a bit like an Alonso back in the day, you know, sort of 2001, getting noticed, putting a fairly poor car in better positions, getting himself a good press, all these things, and then suddenly you're the name that people talk about, and you're not just a pay driver. I know he isn't a pay driver, but you're not just a pay driver, someone who'll be in the sport for a season. Maybe he has a long-term future.
Karun.
I think there's no question about it. Bianchi started off the season as clearly being head and shoulders above the first three races. But I thought in Bahrain, he didn't have a particularly good weekend. I don't know, for whatever reason. You know, obviously, he didn't have the car for FP1, but I don't think that's actually an excuse, because FP1 in Bahrain is just dusty anyway. But he only out-qualified Chilton by 3 tenths and Van der Garde by a couple of tenths. So I think, as these guys have said, it's a question of, across the rest of the season, can he sustain that? I mean, he's had a great start. There's no question about it. But can he sustain that?
It would be remiss of me to not go through this podcast without getting on my usual hobby horse on that. I'll be interested in Karun's opinion on Tony Fernandez's tweet following QPR's relegation, that it took them three seasons to make Caterham a success. And these would be the three seasons in which they failed to score a point and into the fourth season where they're now bottom of the Constructors' Championship. Can you just enlighten us on what actually they've made a success of at Caterham?
Well, you probably dropped me in it. I mean, I suppose I could give them a call and find out because, as you rightly said, I think I think in year two, I remember sitting in a podcast with you when you were reading direct quotes. I remember you being very, very clear there had to be a direct quote you read out from their then CTO about them scoring points that year and being midfield. And obviously, 2 years on, it hasn't happened. So. Yeah, let's see. I mean, they've always said, though, in their defense, from the start of the season, they've said Barcelona is the big one because they've effectively ran last year's cast. So if it doesn't happen in Barcelona, I think we'll, by the time we get to our Silverstone pub cast, you can be on a full-on rant again.
My worry is if you're a Queen's Park Rangers fan, that if they feel that finishing bottom is successful, they'll be in League Two before too long.
Ed, you're going to come in.
I think Caterham will learn quite a nasty lesson about managing expectations and not being quite so optimistic about things, and also that actually competing as a team in top level sport is pretty difficult. I mean, Tony Fernandes will have realised that with QPR as well. Money's been invested in Caterham, not monstrous amounts of money, but enough money to make it into a credible team. A huge amount of money was invested in QPR, but both seem to lack the direction and the management initially to deliver on what was expected of them. Caterham now, they've got some good people. They've moved to Lee Field. The upgrade they put on the car in Bahrain was good. If the Spain one is as good as well, that'll be a good step for them. It'll still be only getting them to the rock bottom of barely acceptable respectability, but at least you start to see them moving a little bit in the right direction, and perhaps part of that process was getting a little bit more realistic about what is possible. And I don't see any reason why they're going to suddenly be leaping into the top 10 next year, but at least you see a few signs that that things are starting to move a little bit more realistically in the right direction.
I mean, in all seriousness, I can't understand why they haven't moved further forward with the people they've got. You know, I think John Eiley from McLaren is very good. I rate Mark Smith very, very highly. He was there when I was, he had just joined when I was at the team. And I remember him coming in immediately and sort of pointing at various bits and pieces that he thought needed to be improved and changed. And I mean, I know from Vijay at Force India also that they felt a big loss when he left. You know, I think they've got lots of good people there, and you know, perhaps as we were, Ed and I were talking about earlier, maybe the problem is with the wind tunnel, perhaps, or whatever. But in terms of people, they don't lack anything in terms of the other midfield teams.
Anthony,
I think the fairest thing you can say with Mauricio, Caterham and HRT not here anymore is that they were lured into the sport when there was the promise of a sort of £40 million budget cap, and it ain't like that. You know, teams like McLaren, Ferrari, they're probably spending north of £300 million a season. You just can't compete with that. I mean, they're doing respectably. Wheels aren't falling off cars. It's not like back in the days of Life F1 and Cologne and all those terrible old sellers that we used to have in the 80s. But, you know, in terms of genuine competitive performance, they've got no chance.
No.
In fairness, though, they weren't under any illusions that they were operating under a budget cap when they were making bold pronouncements about what they'd achieve in 2010 and 2011. That's the counter-argument. But I think that again comes back to the Caterham ownership needing to be a little bit more realistic about what is possible. You know, if they sat there now and said, we're not going to score points for the next 3 years, we just want to slowly build up, we might fluke a few, but you know, we know it's going to take a very long time to catch up with even your Toro Rossos and your established teams. You'd think, yeah, we'll take them a little bit more seriously. And you are beginning to start to see a bit of a move towards that. Everyone's very much downplaying the expectations and the predictions. And perhaps that's a reflection of a more realistic management approach.
To be fair to John Booth and Graham Loudon, I think that's the approach they kind of had. You know, I've never heard them actually come out and say we're going to be midfielders scoring points. And I mean, we all know John for a long time. They're racers, aren't they? They've been around the block for a long time, and perhaps that's the difference.
Andy, final word on that?
I have to, you know, I often criticise, but I have to say that I was impressed with the update they put on the car for the last one. And you know, if the step forward they're able to make in Barcelona's of a similar size, they may be on the cusp of making the Toro Rosso or Williams or even Gutierrez's Cyber think twice in qualifying. And I look forward to seeing it. I'd love to come into one of these and be proved wrong.
Okay, well, the reason I gave you last word was because you started it, so you had to finish it.
In fairness, they started.
I think that's enough of F1, so we'll bid farewell to the editor of F1 Racing. Thank you very much indeed, Anthony Rowlandson. And we'll welcome Kevin Turner, who is the features editor of Autosport. Welcome, Kevin.
Hi, everyone.
Nice to have you along. So let's have a look through the rest of the motorsport world. And we'll start with you, Karun. How has life as a GT racer started?
The cars jump around a lot more. And it's very different. I mean, we had a good start to the season, finished fifth in the first race. But then I got a rude awakening into GT world when Mr. Lowe biffed my teammate out in round two. So it's an interesting start, but obviously off to Le Mans next, which is probably my highlight of the year.
And this is something that a lot of people would be interested to know. How does competing in that compare to competing in F1? Do you feel when you're doing something like that, oh, this isn't quite proper, I'd rather be driving around in an HRT at the back because that matters? Because I think a lot of Formula One fans look at it that way, that, you know, after F1, you're out to pasture and you're just driving around in higher cars for nothing, which isn't what it's about, is it?
No, I think, I mean, there's still a lot of good racing drivers out there at those levels of racing. And actually, you often find that they're, you know, the kind of specialists in that category. And therefore, when you've come from single-seaters, it does take a while to get into it. You know, like the first weekend at Nogaro, I was arriving at the quick corners 25, 30 kilometers quicker than my teammate. And it still felt like I was going too slow. But obviously, you know, over time, you have to change your style. And by the time I got to Zolder, I was a couple of tenths quicker than him. But I think, ultimately, though, I'd love to go back to prototypes and Le Mans and LMP1. I thoroughly enjoyed that last year. And as I said, looking forward to going back to Le Mans this year.
You mentioned Loeb taking your teammate out, but he's been quite impressive, really, for a rally driver to get on the tarmac.
Yeah, I mean, there's no questioning his natural ability, obviously. But I think it also helps the fact that they're the only team that had a full, massive winter test program. And the McLaren that he's driving is an exceptionally good car. I mean, I think this whole balance of performance thing is, I have to say, one of the big things I still don't understand about GT racing. Because, you know, you're sort of driving on the straight and there's, you know, a Lamborghini or a McLaren are just driving past me down in a straight line. And supposedly it's been corrected to equalize the performance, which I can't comprehend, to be perfectly honest, yet.
When the driver's involved in the series, I understand it. What chance are the rest of us got?
It's simple. Drive quicker.
I can't.
If all the cars are the same, drive quicker.
The throttle's going through the bulkhead. I can't push it any longer.
That's the brake.
Okay, we are working our way around the motorsport world. In GP2, a new team with a bizarre name is making waves. Who are they, Ed?
Well, basically, at heart, they're iSport. Obviously, you're a top team, championship-winning team. They couldn't make it work financially without sinking a little bit more money into it than they'd like to, so they sold on. But the Russian guy who's bought it, Igor Mazepa, who seems to have plenty of money to throw at it, so he's come in. He's been at both the races. He's very, very enthusiastic about it. I'm told that after Sam Bird won the sprint race in Bahrain, Sam was told in no uncertain terms that he would not be keeping the trophy, which Sam was fine with. But they've been sensible. They haven't just bought the entry and the team. They've carried over a decent amount of it, a decent number of mechanics and personnel, the expertise, the setups, etc. So they have effectively created a continuation team, if you want to put it that way. And you have to say they've got to be taken seriously as championship contenders. But apparently, slowly, there are some changes to the way the team operates. It's not completely seamless. So I think we will see the team gradually establish its own identity over the next couple of years.
I mean, I raced with iSport in 2008 and, you know, till date, they're the best race team I've worked with in my career. Fantastic guys driven by engineering, very no-nonsense. And they've, as Ed said, they've carried on going to races, at least one of them. But also, you know, some of the other engineers, I know the guy who's gone there, a German guy called Alex Zorkling, has gone in as chief engineer. And I worked with Alex for a few tests as well, very good guy. So I think they've been sensible in a way that you've seen other... I mean, the grid now, when I look at the list of teams in GP2, none of them, I could barely recognize two or three names from when I raced there barely 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So the category's changed dramatically in the last 3 years in terms of the teams. But I think, as Ed says, Russian time have been, I think, quite intelligent in getting, you know, continuity from the previous team owners.
What I like about what they've done is they've given a free drive to Sandberg, and I think certainly a heavily subsidised one to Tom Dillman, his teammate, two very talented guys that were sort of struggling to make their careers work because they'd run out of money. And we know in both their cases, these are good guys. And I think this is probably Sam's last roll of the dice as a single-seater driver, and it's really good to see him properly grabbing out with both hands. I think he's got a genuine shot at this championship now, especially with the way that ART, the sort of traditional powerhouse of GP2, have not had a really strong start to the season, and Collado's on the back foot a bit.
Yeah, the only thing about GP2 again this year, I think, is I wonder about the depth of drivers. It's not like how it was in between 2005 and 2009, or 2010 even. I think as World Series has again delivered another top quality, top 10 really of drivers. There's got to be questions about how the two championships are going to compare.
Well, ultimately, GP2 is incredibly expensive, and it is extremely difficult for teams that are established in the back half of the grid, if you like, to attract drivers, because fair enough, if you're going to pay €1.5 million plus for a top team, a proven championship team, you think, okay, you're going to get something out of it. But then for a team, you'll say, hang on a minute, when did you last win a race? This just isn't value, and then it kind of becomes this self-fulfilling thing that people think, well, I'll be better off going elsewhere, because people want, if they're going to pay top dollar, they want to have a top team and a shot at winning. And the vicious circle is, if you don't have the drivers in who can deliver, the next year you don't have the interest. And we have seen a genuine shrinking in the depth of the field. I mean, if you look at the first GP2 season, which I think Andrew covered, you look down that entry list, and it was very high quality. There were people running around kind of 19th, 20th place who were pretty serious drivers and wouldn't look out of place scoring points relatively regularly. So that's kind of what this series needs to get back to, but that's much easier said than done.
I did seasons 1 and 2 in GP2, and I really disliked the sort of "it was better back then" type mentality, but in GP2's case, it really genuinely was better back then. As Ed alluded to, you'd have guys like Olivier Pla, who's probably the best LMP2 driver, or certainly one of the top LMP2 drivers in the world at the moment, struggling to sort of make the top 20. It was absolutely loaded with talent. There were one or two guys there that were sort of making up the numbers, but pretty much every team had someone that on their day could win a race. That is definitely not the case now.
Well, I think you just look at last season. Obviously, Valsecchi and Razia were the two stars of the season, if you like. I remember 2008, I think, when Razia was there. You know, again, it's, as Andy said, you know, you would struggle to see him in top 15 on occasion. So whether it's a sign of how much he's improved or the sign of much the series has changed is arguable.
Now, in sports cars, Audi trounced Toyota in the opening round of the WEC. Andrew, you were there.
Yeah, freezing cold Silverstone. Blimey, was miserable. Fair play to those hardy souls that made it out there. I mean, there weren't that many of them, but those that did certainly deserved the race that they saw, actually. Mm. And we were talking right back at the beginning of this podcast about real racing or whatever, but what we saw was a genuine battle between those two lead Audis. And those cars are super impressive. I'm not surprised that Caroon longs for a return to prototype, because you watch those things go around and they're carrying a serious amount of downforce. They've got a serious amount of power. You can't hear them. You've got no idea whether they're coming or not, but when they arrive, they make an impression. I think you can't draw too much into it because it was last year's Toyota. This isn't the car they're running at Le Mans, but I think they expected to be a little bit more competitive than that, and the pace of the new Audi would have been a bit of a wake-up call to them.
Kevin Turner.
Yeah, I did speak to Oliver Jarvis just before the Spa round this weekend, and he's pretty convinced that Toyota will be a lot stronger, not just because of the new car that they're bringing along, but he seemed to think that Toyota had a bit of a tyre issue getting it into the back to those round things again, getting into the right window, so it made Audi's advantage look bigger than it actually was. I think Audi are expecting Toyota to be a lot stronger as well.
Ed.
I think Toyota are quite worried. Obviously, there's quite a few people around in Toyota Motorsport who are around in F1 days, so keep my eye to the ground there. And I think there's some real concerns that Audi have taken a bigger step than they anticipated. Obviously, they're extrapolating because it was the old car at Silverstone, but I think they're expecting a massively, massively tough fight this year. And as always, we've seen Audi, whenever they're challenged, they always manage to up their game, particularly especially for the big races. So you go to somewhere like Le Mans, and it'd be interesting to see how the battle shakes out there, because Toyota could have a difficult season everywhere else. If they win Le Mans, it's a successful season, effectively. Peugeot suffered from the inverse of this, where they could win everything except Le Mans, and it seemed like a failure. So I think this is going to be a fascinating battle. But it's brilliant, because you don't just want a manufacturer to come in and find it easy. You want Audi to push the boundaries and make the opposition go, right, this is serious, and then they'll push out all the stops, and that's what it should be with a proper battle with proper prototype cars.
I think nobody in the world who goes and sees that Yost Audi operation at work at a race weekend can come away unimpressed. I mean, I've seen a lot of teams operate in a lot of different championships, but that one is right up there with any top Formula One team. I think it's so slick when they have a shunt, the way the cars are repaired, even the way the jacks come out and the garage is laid out for the cars, and you look at the accidents they had last year, and there were so many silly sort of collisions with other cars and trips to the gravel and all that, but they had the cars out and turned around in such short time. It is a mighty impressive operation.
I remember a few years ago at Le Mans, when it was still legal to do this, during the race, going and watching Audi do their in-race rear end change, effectively, and it's impossible how quickly they do it. It's a few minutes. You look away and it's done, and you think, well, how's that happened? It's just the combination of looking at something they can do, doing it perfectly, and then drilling it so you can do it in the blink of an eye is absolutely incredible. And that ethos has always carried through, and that's something that anyone who wants to beat them is going to have to try and match. And then when you go to an environment like the Le Mans 24 Hours, that can add up to a huge difference, because the reliability is so good. It's all about troubleshooting the odd small problem if you get it. And Yost in particular are outstanding at this.
Kev, you had something to say on this.
It's probably worth mentioning that the professionalism goes further down the grid as well. Obviously not to Audi levels because of all the investment that they've got. But you look at the GTE class, and you've got factory drivers and factory involvement with the various manufacturers. You've got Porsche, Ferrari, Aston Martin, Chevrolet, and of course we're going to have the Vipers back at Le Mans this year. And so some of those races, between the front guys, it really is a sprint for 24 hours, just like the prototype guys. And there's some proper quality there. It's quite often the closest racing is in GTE.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to sports car racing last year, I thought I'd heard from Bruno Senna. I mean, he hated it. He absolutely, at the time, he's obviously gone back, which is kind of ironical. But at the time, he said, oh, you'll hate LMP1, that's DTM or touring, something like that's the way forward, because you just drive around trying to save fuel and brakes the whole time, and it's just dull. I tell you what, I arrived at the first race at Sebring, and we ran quali map the entire race, and we were attacking, and same at Le Mans. We had the clutch let go after 7 hours, and we did every pit stop without a clutch, but it was, maximum attack for the entire race, and I think it's brilliant. It's fantastic for drivers. You really enjoy it.
I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen more clashes between the prototypes and the GTs as well. Whereas, perhaps a couple of decades ago, you could afford to lose a few seconds, just, I'm not going to go past him, I'll wait till the straight. Now you've got the double whammy. The cars, their advantage of the prototypes, it tends to be in the corners rather than in a straight line, and they can't afford to. When you've got Le Mans being won by 13 seconds or whatever it is, you can't afford to give away time. So you do chuck it down the inside, and that's when you're going to get a few moments when the GTs don't see you coming.
We've got to my highlight now. Tin tops, here we go. BTCC this weekend at Thruxton. Jason Plato has a narrow lead at the top of the standings, but it's been Andrew Jordan in the Pertec Racing Honda that's been leading the chasing pack. Does that come as a surprise, Kev?
I think we've known that he's been quick for a while. He's one of the top. I think on average he was the second best qualifier last year. His problem has been putting together a full campaign in the races, knowing when to go for a move, when not to. I think he's been sort of perhaps in the past too easily bullied out the way, but we saw at Brands he was prepared to have a go at Jason on the last lap. There seems to be a bit of a different vibe with the team this year, and they can run with ballast as well. I think that the works guys are expecting them to struggle as soon as Andrew got the ballast on, and if anything he got even quicker at Donington, so it'd be interesting to see if he can maintain the challenge. It's certainly an interesting factor to this year's battle.
I went to the Daytona 24 this year, where of course he was running in one of the support races in a Honda with I couldn't even tell you what the regulations are for that class. So quite by Zantone. Anyway, I was speaking to him and Mike there, and they were super confident. They said, for the first time ever, we've had a proper winter test program, and I think we're seeing the results of that. They clearly tested with a bit of weight in the car, so they know what they're doing with it setup wise. And you have to say he's driving really well. And as you say, he's a super quick qualifier, and that really helps. You don't want to be in that mid pack where the nonsense all goes on. You want to be up front.
Ed?
I think one of the great strengths that Andrew has is that he has Mike Jordan, his father, behind him. You know, Mike's a really shrewd guy, a BTCC race winner in his own right, won at Mondello Park a few years ago. I think we'd have been both there for that. You know, really intelligent, good analytical approach. He's also been involved, obviously, with Andrew's career throughout, you know, putting him in rallycross, you know, building him up through, he did the Seats and the Clios, and then bringing him into BTCC very early. So he's got to, what, 23, I think he is? Season of touring cars as a very mature driver. And I think it's no surprise to see him taking the step forward this year. And I think he knows he needs to. I mean, Kevin will probably know better than me, but I saw that move he made on Jason, which was pretty rash at Brands Hatch, was him realising, yeah, I need to take these chances when they come. And that's a classic corner for you thinking you have a chance with, and then the door very rapidly closes. He kind of got away with it because they both got out. I'm sure Jason would have been much less polite about what had happened after the race had they not both dug themselves out of the gravel. But then you saw at Donington when he was behind Gordon Shedden, I think it was, in the first race, he realised there was no way through and was able to take kind of a mature approach. I think that surely is going to be the key to whether he can be a championship challenger this year, whether he can weekend in, weekend out, know when to attack, know when not to, because there's guys there who have that absolutely down to a T.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Donington was a better demonstration of him getting the judgment right in the first race when he had a bit more weight. He thought, not sure it's worth a move here on the works car. And then when Shed's had the weight on for the second race, he was behind and he thought, oh, I've got a bit of an opportunity, made the move. And he was then well out the way when we had Jason, Matt and Gordon all, you know, side by side through the caners and all sorts of good fighting, which actually was a clean fight as well, which was nice to see. But Andrew was well ahead of it by then.
Andrew?
Just a shout out really to WSR and Colin Turkington that obviously won that final race at Donington. I was at Brands Hatch for the first race and those cars were just a little bit too new and a couple of them aren't really running properly just yet, but especially there. But it's clearly got potential, and to see Colin back in the championship, obviously he hasn't really raced in it since he won the title a few years back, it's good to see. And the fact that he's right bang on it and so are WSR, I think that bodes well for the season.
Yeah, there are certain elements there that I think have got the other teams worried. First of all, it's a smaller car. It's much more like the Civic size than it is, the MGs or the Toyotas. And the Civic, I think, is fair to say, is the pace setter at the moment in NGTC. And it's rear-wheel drive. And some of the other teams are saying, well, you know, if they get it sorted, which WSR probably will, let's be honest, and it's looking after its tyres better, and it's got better traction, oh, and by the way, it's running the same weight as the others, it doesn't have to have a weight penalty like they used to with rear-wheel drive cars, I think they're a bit concerned that Colin will then do in races one and two what he did at race three at Donington, which was get the lead and disappear. But it'll be interesting to see how quickly they get to get up right at the sharp end.
And to finish off on Andy Jordan, Andrew, you absolutely hit the nail on the head. He's come into this season with a confidence, and whether that comes from winning the independent title last year or wherever it comes from, but just from the outset this year, he has walked around all weekend just with this cool, calm confidence, and I think he could be a force to be reckoned with as the year goes on, that's for sure.
Yeah, and he doesn't have quite at this point all the sort of baggage and rivalries Matt and Jason or whatever. He's sort of, he can sort of maintain it.
Come, my boy.
Yes, I'm sure.
Do you want to use this opportunity to encourage people to come to your KX thing on the weekend at Thruxton?
What a good idea. Kev, are you going to talk about it or shall I?
I can do, yeah, why not? It's one thing that Alan is in fact hosting every meeting, and the idea is to get a few BTCC guys together and chat about it, so supported by KX. So Jason's there at every one, as are some of his two of his academy guys every meeting. And I think this week we're hoping to get, funnily enough, just talking about WSR, we've got Dick Bennett, Rob Collard, and Jason himself has managed to persuade Colin to come along, Colin Turkington, so that'd be good. And Adam Morgan as well, who is another rising guy that we have not talked about this time, but he's turned off the magnets this year. We knew he was quick last year, and now he's not crashing. So what, three top fives, I think, at Donington, so yes, it'd be good to talk to him as well.
Yeah, very impressive. KX question time on the Saturday evening, around about 6:30, every BTCC weekend, and we generally tend to find the bar is where we tend to do it.
Yes.
That's where we're going to be this weekend.
The questions get more and more interesting as the night goes by.
They do, rather, yeah, and lots of great prizes to win as well.
And I think you can find out certainly more about it on our Facebook page. And can you submit questions from there as well?
I believe you can, yes. So, I'll be on the panel this week as well. So,
are you? Good. Well, we shall look forward to it.
More wisdom.
Something like that.
I just think we need to quickly copyright the word pubcast before these BTCC boys come
from us. Yeah, that's a very good point. Well, I've got interest in both camps, so I don't think you're allowed the copyright on that. That's just about it for this podcast. Keep an ear out for the next one, which I'm guessing will be pre-Le Mans, Andrew.
I hope so.
Yeah, we keep our fingers crossed for that. I'm, as we've already said, off to Thruxton this weekend for more BTCC action for the third meeting of the year. So where are we all off to? Where are we off to next, Andrew?
I'm going to Thruxton on Sunday.
Very good. We shall welcome you there. Karun?
I'll be watching Formula 3 at Hockenheim on telly.
Will you indeed? Very good. Kev, you'll be at Thruxton.
I will be at Thruxton, yeah.
And Ed?
I think I'll do Thruxton and a bit of Spanish Grand Prix the week after.
You're coming along to Thruxton, are you?
That'd be the idea, provided you promise it doesn't rain as much as it did last year, and that I do not get a puncture on the way home and realise that my spare also has a puncture.
Oh, you didn't have
that
a good weekend then. Oh dear. Right, okay, the weather is set fair for this weekend at Thruxton, and it's my favourite one of the year. I absolutely love it, and the reason being that when I interview drivers when they get back from practice, qualifying or the race, they've always got slightly wider eyes than they had before they went out, and I think it's absolutely fantastic.
Oh, it is. If you see Andrew Jordan's qualifying pole lap from last year,
genius,
wow,
wasn't it?
Brilliant.
It was absolutely fantastic. Well, that's it, everyone. Another Autosport podcast. Thank you to all of my guests, to Andrew Vandenberg, the Autosport Editor-in-Chief, to Anthony Rowlandson, the Editor of F1 Racing, Ed Straw, F1 Editor of Autosport, Karun Chanduk, Racing Driver and General Everybody Media Does Everything, and Kevin Turner, the Features Editor of Autosport. And that, my friends, is a lap.